Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Gaitis, Judge Ross, Judge Wheelock, the Honorable Theodora Gaitis presiding.
Good morning. You may all be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's nice to see you all this morning. Today's February 1st, and we have one case scheduled for oral argument and two cases on our non-oral calendar. I see counsel are both here for the first case, our oral case. That case is State of Minnesota Appellant versus Ayub Dawood Abdusalam Respondent. It's actually two consolidated cases. The case numbers are A221551 and A221552. I know both of our attorneys are experienced arguing before this court, so I'll be real brief with my summary of the rules here this morning. Appellant will have 15 minutes to argue. Respondent will have 15 minutes, and then appellant will have the opportunity for a five-minute rebuttal. I simply ask that before you begin making your argument to the court, you please introduce yourselves and identify the party you're representing. And that's for the purpose of the audio recording that we're making of your arguments this morning, which will be available on the court's website shortly. So with that, are both of you ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Anna Light, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent Appellant, State of Minnesota, in this matter. The district court erred in its legal conclusion in this case that the vehicles did not constitute dangerous weapons. If the district court had considered the full and correct statutory definition of dangerous weapons in these cases, it would have concluded that there is probable cause that the vehicles were used in a manner likely to cause great bodily harm or death. Because there is at least a fact question for a jury on every element of these offenses, we ask that this court reverse and allow these cases to proceed to trial. I want to emphasize that we are only at the probable cause phase of these cases. This court is not tasked with looking at sufficiency of the evidence. This court is not tasked with determining whether the state has proved beyond a reasonable doubt every element of the offenses. We are only here to determine whether there is a reasonable probability that the respondent committed second-degree riot. And we submit that we have met that standard. I want to focus on the word likely that the district court ignored in its analysis. The statute does not define likely, so therefore we can look to the dictionary definitions as well as this court's interpretation of the word in other cases. The dictionary defines likely as probable or plausible or reasonably expected. And in cases, looking at the word likely in the child endangerment and child neglect area, cases have said that likely means more likely than not, or more probable than not.
Is that the definition the state would have us adopt, more likely than not?
I think in my briefing I focused more on the dictionary definition, so I think probable, plausible, but then I also did want to highlight that this court has interpreted the term previously in a child endangerment context.
It seems... Likely seems like an easy word, but I'll tell you that I've tried to, I'm struggling with it. I mean, likely could mean, it has, I think, different meanings, and I'll just throw it out there and you can push back and test me if you think I'm wrong, but one meaning is it's probable, more likely than not. It's likely versus, one is likely, one is unlikely, more likely, you know, if it's a 30% chance of rain, it's not likely because it's likely that it won't rain. On the other hand, likely might also mean, I think you've included this as an alternative definition in your brief, sort of within the realm of expectation, sort of not unlikely. So if I didn't shovel my walk, I might think, well, there's only a 10% chance that someone's going to fall down on my slippery walk. But if someone does, I would be strange for me to say, well, that was unlikely, even if it was 80% chance or 90% chance that no one would walk by and fall. Sure. So what is the state's definition? And first of all, am I correct that it could be sort of two very different meanings? Mm-hmm. And if so, is it ambiguous?
I don't think it's ambiguous as to the legal question that this court needs to resolve. I think it gets tricky when it turns into the fact question for the jury to decide.
Well, before we even get to that, I mean, we have to know what the word means.
Yes. Right.
Before we can know whether there's probable cause.
Sure. And I mean, I think probable, plausible, reasonably expected. And so I think...
So you disagree with the 50% more likely than not as the definition for likely?
I don't know if I necessarily disagree. I don't think...
But plausible is different. I mean, plausible is in the realm of possibility, as you suggested with one version of your definition. Those seem to be different things.
Sure. I'm not sure that they are. And I do want to continue to acknowledge this court's case law, and it was the Weiss, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, case from 2013 looking at child endangerment that does say more likely than not. So I don't want to necessarily go against that or advocate for a rule that would, create a split on that definition. So, and I think it's also, when you look at these cases, I understand that, it can't just be any in the realm of possibility. I do think that it needs to be more than that, because otherwise that would, the exception would swallow the rule, as it were, for what could constitute a dangerous weapon. So I may not be answering your question, but I'm not sure where this court falls on that.
Where does the state want us to fall? If you had to, let's assume we're publishing this case and we're going to say, likely in this statute, the dangerous weapon statute means, and you would tell us what should we fill in?
I would say to follow the dictionary definition, which cites both probable and plausible.
Well, that's the problem. It gives us both, and they're different definitions. Mm-hmm. For a criminal statute, we've got to be a little more specific. What would the state have us adopt?
I think it adds more certainty to the definition to have it be a slightly higher burden, and so I would be comfortable with probable.
More probable than not.
More probable than not.
So, all right. So in this case, if it's more probable than not, we would probably know based upon the number of incidents. If we've had 50 incidents of this spinning behavior, if it's more probable than not, we probably have 25 or so incidents of bodily injury over time, serious bodily injury or death.
Well, I would disagree with that. I don't think we can reduce it to a statistical number as far as looking at because the case law says that we must look at how the device or instrumentality, in the manner in which it was used, and whether that makes it likely that great bodily harm would occur.
Right, but if it's more likely than not that using the vehicle in this manner would cause great bodily harm or death, I mean, wouldn't we assume that there would be instances of great bodily harm or death if there have been numerous occasions when this behavior was being engaged in by the defendant and others?
I don't think we can assume that, because I think what the legislature and statute is getting at is to prevent great bodily harm and death, and that's why we don't have to prove harm. In addition, with second-degree riot, there is no specific intent to harm.
No, I understand that, but if you're saying that the definition is more likely than not that engaging in this behavior would result in great bodily harm or death, and we've had multiple instances of individuals engaging this behavior And I don't know, maybe there's been injuries, maybe not. I don't know. I don't know if the state knows one way or the other. But it would seem to be at least logical that we'd have some instances of great bodily harm or death, and that I'm assuming at trial the state would introduce that sort of evidence.
So I can say, you know, and this is a consolidated appeal, and there's two cases, two sets of facts. In one incident, in the April 9th incident, a spectator on foot was struck by the spinning vehicle and knocked to the ground. You can see on the surveillance video, he does get up, and by my review of the video, it appears that he's limping away. That victim was never identified, so we don't know the extent of his injuries.
Well, and Ms. Light, the complaint does allege that there have been numerous incidents of spectators on foot being hit by cars engaging in this activity. In terms of our decision here, you know, whether there was probable cause, how are we to view that allegation? Are we required to assume that it's true?
I think, you're looking at the facts in the complaint, and assuming that those are true and fact questions that we would be proving beyond a reasonable doubt at trial. Have we alleged enough facts to make it reasonably probable that the respondent, that we've met the elements of second degree riot? So yes, I think you would be looking at that. And in that context, I think it's in the complaints as well. In other instances of these takeovers, there's been firearms that have been shot out of the spinning vehicles. There's been fireworks that have been set off.
But that's not alleged here. I mean, it's not alleged that...
these instances.
That this individual had firearms or... I mean, the instrumentality here is the vehicle, right?
Correct.
So in what way would we incorporate other conduct into the allegations here? I mean, I saw them in the complaint, but wasn't sure how we were to factor them in for deciding whether the car is a dangerous weapon.
Sure. And I think that's more getting at, you know, the unlawful assembly, the disturbance of the peace, as Your Honor pointed out, if you're looking at 50 incidents of these takeovers, you would be expecting 25 injuries. So if you are inclined to look at the context of how these takeovers are occurring, I think it's also important to note that this respondent, we have evidence that he is a promoter and organizer of these events, and so he's aware of the conduct that occurs typically at these events all across Hennepin County. And so I do think, you know, it would factor in.
But it doesn't change our analysis. I mean, if our focus, as the state points out in your brief, is on whether the vehicle is a dangerous weapon, then those things would be important for trial overall, but not for this element.
Correct. And so looking at specifically the vehicles used in these two incidents, I think it is important to note that these vehicles are used in a planned event that are organized for the unlawful purpose of a very dangerous activity, where drivers are taking, multi-ton vehicles into a tight, confined intersection that has people on foot in the center of the intersection, as well as spectators on foot around the edges, and they accelerate the car so quickly that the tires spin, the car slides around to do these donuts, clouds of smoke from the exhaust, chunks of debris flying, and with the goal of maneuvering these vehicles to, hopefully the point of almost out of control without, going over the line. And then, in addition, there's people in the passengers of the vehicles either completely outside of the vehicles or hanging most of their bodies outside the doors, windows, and in one of these incidents, riding in the open trunk of the vehicle as the vehicle is whipped around very fast. And when you look at the video, you see the cars whipping around, you know, within inches of the spectators on foot.
So given that activity that you've summarized and that we've seen in the video, that videos that were introduced as exhibits in this case, I mean, do we need to determine whether, you know, in 50% of these cases people are getting injured, or can we look at that activity alone and determine that it's more likely than not that this type of activity is going to result in great bodily harm or death?
And I agree with the latter. I don't think it needs to be a statistical calculus of 50%. I think it's looking at the manner in which these vehicles are used, with the people vulnerable, you know, all around, and whether that creates a scenario where it's more likely than not that someone is going to suffer great bodily harm or death.
What evidence at trial would, what type of evidence is conceivable to establish that element, that more likely than not?
You know, I mean, I think that doesn't necessarily come into the court's consideration at this point, because
No, not at this point. But I'm trying to, going forward, as we define it, because we're going to, if we agree with you, we would tell the district court, this is the standard. It's more likely than not is a standard. If we agree with you, then we'd say the district court was wrong and dismissing the case of probable cause. Assuming we're going to give some instruction as to how, what the district court does with that definition, what would it be?
Well, I mean, I think at this point, the instruction is enough facts have been alleged to create a fact question for the jury to weigh and decide. When the jury views the video and whatever other evidence we you know, offer at trial. I think, you know, in the child endangerment world, that is also considered, I see I'm out of time, has considered the likely language, the case law says it's a fact question for the jury. So I don't know if much more guidance is needed from this court on that point. And I see my time is up. I will take my 5 minutes.
You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you very much. And next we will hear from counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Drake Metzger, and I represent the respondent, Mr. Ayub Abdul Salam, in these consolidated pretrial appeals. The district court order dismissing both of these cases for lack of probable cause should be affirmed, because under this statute, under the felony riot statute, a vehicle is not a dangerous weapon. I did raise a statutory interpretation issue, and I think as it relates to that issue, the statute is ambiguous, I believe, as to what armed with means. But as the court has indicated, too, I would agree that it is also ambiguous as to what likely means.
The court hasn't indicated that. The court is questioning that.
Well, I would agree with the court's questioning.
Well, what does likely to mean?
Well, I think likely to the Black's Law definition, I believe, that I cited in a footnote in my brief, is that reasonably expected or showing a strong tendency. And, I think inherently it is going to be somewhat vague in terms of trying to define likely, but I think reasonably expected makes a lot of sense in this situation.
So what is reasonably expected? Is it more likely than not? Is that reasonable? Is it 51%? What would you say is...
Well, I would say that there's a reasonable expectation that there will be death or great bodily harm. And I think looking at these incidents, I guess relating to disregarding the statutory interpretation issue, I think if you look at this incident here, driving these vehicles to do donuts is not likely or reasonably expected to produce death or great bodily harm.
Why not? Why wouldn't, at this stage, why wouldn't we say there's enough for the state to bring the charge forward, and then the state has to produce evidence of reasonableness or reasonable likelihood? Why wouldn't the state be able to bring experts, for example, to say, knowing how centrifugal force works, this is how likely it is for someone to fall out of the vehicle, how likely it is for the vehicle to lose control and strike someone on the side, and therefore how likely it is for someone to be injured. Why wouldn't at this stage we at least allow the state to produce evidence to establish the likely to element at trial?
I think that under the probable cause standard, looking at the complaint and all of the exhibits that were submitted, I think the state failed to really even make that allegation that it's likely to, other than just the charging language, that is likely to produce death or great bodily harm. And in this situation specifically, again, looking at the circumstances.
Well, that's usually all you do, I mean, in a complaint, is you use the language of the statute, and if it's true that people are being struck by vehicles, and we know that occasionally people are being struck by vehicles, or we don't know the extent of their injuries. For all we know, they've left with fractured bones and they've been hospitalized. We don't know that. I mean, why can't the state at least have the opportunity to present that evidence at trial?
I think in this case specifically, the record indicates that the officer who watched was in the helicopter videotaping the incident. When that individual is struck by the car, the officer says he got up and ran away. I think there's no indication or allegation that he suffered death or great bodily harm.
Well, it doesn't have to. The question is just whether the conduct, I mean, you don't have to have actual conduct that occurred that, you don't have to have great bodily harm or death on the occasion that's charged, right?
I agree.
So why wouldn't the state be able to show, well, this happened in this case. Maybe in this case he didn't suffer great bodily harm, but, you know, it frequently happens that people are struck, and sometimes they do have end up with great bodily harm. Why doesn't the state have the opportunity to present evidence of that?
Well, I think that would be required to be alleged in the complaint then. And
what
I don't
would
believe
be?
That it was. That this activity is likely to cause great bodily harm.
I thought
harm.
That was what the allegation is. That's what the charge is.
That's what the charge is, but I think there's no actual allegation to that fact. There's no evidence in the record where I believe it's been stated or alleged that this activity is likely to produce death or great bodily harm. I think there's an allegation that these have happened in the past and that there have been individuals that have been struck or they come very close to individuals. But I think as it relates to actually establishing or alleging that this activity is likely to produce.
So you're asking us to assume that those individuals who have been hit by vehicles have not suffered great bodily injury?
Correct.
Why would we do that at the probable cause stage?
Well, I think the state has a burden to allege that.
Allege what?
That in these, if they're saying that, you know, we have a basis to believe that this activity is likely to produce death or great bodily harm based on these incidents. Essentially, what I feel the state is doing here is asking us to presume that just because you're not driving a car normally, and there's spectators, that is likely to produce death or great bodily harm.
Well, Mr. Metzger, I have the complaint in front of me, and it says there have been numerous incidents of spectators on foot being hit by the spinning vehicle because the vehicle lost control. Isn't that sufficient to get this to a jury?
No, I think that the state would need to allege that there's been previous incidents of great bodily harm or death. And
what if the state doesn't know? What if all the state knows at this time is that people have been hit by cars? And why is it the state's burden at this stage to establish the degree of injury rather than to leave that for trial? And not to show injury of the individuals that were hit, but the likelihood that those individuals either did or could have suffered great bodily harm. I think that's the way the statute is written, not that people have actually been injured.
Yeah, and I agree that that's how the statute's written, but I think that gets to trying to define what likely means. You know, what is this based on? What is likely based on?
That's why I asked you to begin with.
Yeah, and I think that there needs, if in this situation, you know, simply saying, well, we don't really know what the extent of the injuries are. We know people have been hit.
No, the state hasn't said we don't know. The state has just alleged that they've been struck by vehicles.
But the state hasn't alleged that there's a history or pattern or likelihood of death or great bodily harm arising out of this activity.
Well, they have alleged likelihood. They haven't alleged a pattern. But do they have to under this statute? I don't see the statutory language that requires that there's actually a history and a pattern of people being injured by the conduct in order to establish.
Well, I think there needs to be something that establishes that the activity is likely to produce death or great bodily harm. And I just don't think, looking at the evidence in the record here, that a vehicle under that definition, looking at the driving behavior that's...
Well, maybe if we're talking about pool noodles, people being struck with pool noodles, we might say, well, you know, we can say without needing an expert, that, you know, these, it's probably that no one was seriously injured or could be seriously injured, but we're talking about motor vehicles striking individuals. If I told you that a car struck a pedestrian, and I told you the person was seriously injured, I'm guessing you wouldn't respond by saying, wow, struck by a vehicle and seriously injured? That's unlikely.
Well, I guess that comes down to the circumstances. You know, I think there's certainly gradations of what type of injury,
Let's put it in the context of this case. If you open the newspaper tomorrow and you saw a report of this conduct, and in that report the observer said, and someone was struck by a car and ended up with a broken pelvis, would you be shocked?
I guess I don't. Again, I don't know. It would come down to the extent of the injuries.
And you wouldn't be shocked.
I wouldn't be shocked that someone getting hit by a car.
Would you be shocked if you found out that the injuries was a broken pelvis or a broken femur? That shock you?
I don't know that a broken femur would shock me, but
well, then if it's not going to shock you, I mean, so it's not unlikely.
I'm not saying that it's unlikely. I guess it comes down to death or bodily great bodily harm, I think.
Isn't a broken femur great bodily harm?
I don't think it's permanent disfigurement or permanent loss of a limb. I think that, you know, under the statutory definition of great bodily harm, I think a broken femur doesn't necessarily...
Fractured spine. I mean, that wouldn't shock you, would it? I mean, just to be frank, it wouldn't shock me. If I watched this conduct and then the next day I saw a report, yeah, the person that got struck had a, you know, suffer from a fractured spine.
Yeah, you're right. Someone getting hit by a car, depending on the speed of the car, would not shock me if they had a fractured spine.
In this conduct, in this circumstance?
I think depending, I would be shocked if someone died in these circumstances. I would be shocked if someone was permanently paralyzed or something like that in these circumstances. I think in these circumstances,
Would you be shocked to learn that someone fell out of the car while the car is spinning around?
I think it would depend on the circumstances.
Well, the allegations are people are hanging out of these cars while they're doing donuts. That wouldn't shock you that someone fell out of a car in that circumstance, would it?
I think it would still depend on the circumstances. You know, if someone's just laying outside the car, so like a situation where maybe the car door's open or, you know, that wouldn't surprise me.
No, they're hanging out the windows like this. They're all the way almost out of the car. They're
hanging out the windows, holding on to the interior of the car. That wouldn't shock me. These cars aren't going, you know, 100 miles an hour spinning in circles. They are going in donuts. And I'm not a physics professor, so I don't know all the ins and outs of centripetal force. But, you know, I don't think that these cars are speeding to the extent where, oh, just that act alone would throw someone from a car. So I would not necessarily be surprised by that in these situations.
You wouldn't be surprised that someone fell out of the car?
Would be thrown from the car, sitting on the side, if their purpose is to, you know, stunt or whatever it's called, where they hang out of the car, holding on to something on the inside of the car, holding on the seatbelt, whatever it may be. That would not shock me, because I would assume that these people are doing this and have done this before, and this is, you know, a hobby of theirs.
No, it wouldn't shock you that they're hanging on. I'm just asking would it shock you to know that someone slipped and fell out of the car?
Again, yes, at these speeds. Okay. You know, the speeds that are observed in these two videos. But that said, I think that in these situations, I just don't think that a vehicle here can be a dangerous weapon. I think this, again, getting into the argument that I made as it relates to armed with. I think if you look at other statutes that use that language, armed with, I do think it's ambiguous in this statute. I think if you look at when...
Well, let's talk about that. So what about this hypothetical? What if an individual with a car and part of a group of people is driving into pedestrians? Wouldn't that amount to armed with a car?
Well, I would say that's assault with. I think if for purposes of riot, if someone drove into somebody,
a riot might be the least of their problems, but in terms of, you know, whether it would be a chargeable offense.
Well, I don't think it should be chargeable under riot. I think it is an assault by, you know, Absolutely, I think that's an assault. I don't think that the purpose of the riot statute is this situation. Looking at when it was enacted, 1993, you're coming off, I think it was the first legislative session after the Rodney King riots out in Los Angeles, you know, where people were rioting in the streets, burning, you know, the city down, things like that. This was enacted, it used to just be the gross misdemeanor riot. And then after that session, they added the first and second degree and third degree. They had the three subdivisions that currently exist. And I think if you look at it in that context, what they're trying to address are those types of situations where you maybe have protesters, you know, demonstrators, whatever the case may be, who you don't want to be armed with dangerous weapons while they're doing that activity. You know, it's not driving conduct. It's not, you know, they're armed with a vehicle. So I think a vehicle is distinguishable and not a dangerous weapon in the context of the statute.
So you have a group of people going to an incident, meets all the other elements of riot, and they meet beforehand and they say, you know, the police are going to be there. We're going to beat them back. You guys bring clubs. You guys bring knives. We'll bring our 4x4 vehicles. You'd say, okay, the guys with the clubs, the guys with the knives, they're armed, but the ones with the vehicles aren't, by your interpretation.
Yes, and I think the statute is vague for that purpose. I think
that's
armed with.
That would be a reasonable interpretation of the statute, that six people were charged, two with guns, two with clubs, two with knives, and two with cars, all with the intent to use in a riot to push the police back, to create a perimeter for the rioters' behavior. You think a reasonable interpretation would exclude the two with vehicles from being charged with riot?
Yeah, I would expect them to be charged with assault. But I think if you look at the other statutes,
because
that
they're not armed with, just to be clear, you're not really armed with a car.
That's what I am arguing, is that you're not armed with a car. And I think
you're holding in your hand a club, you're holding in your hand a knife, and you're holding in your hand a steering wheel, but all of them to operate the tools to cause harm. But the car's not, you're not armed with the car. I just want to be
clear.
That is
my position.
All right.
And I think if you look at the other statutes that use the armed with language as opposed to just assault with, for instance.
Just to push a little further, is there a case somewhere that supports that theory, that you can't be armed with a car? Either under Minnesota statute or anywhere in the country?
I don't know anywhere in the country. I did not do a complete, you know, survey of all the country or the different states, but I will say the complete lack of any case that establishes a motor vehicle is a dangerous weapon. I see my time is up.
You can finish your answer.
But I think the complete lack of any case law in Minnesota that establishes that a vehicle is a dangerous weapon for purposes of felony riot, I think speaks to that. I think all the cases and all the case law that I reviewed are guns, clubs, bats, and that's it. And it's mostly in the context of a group fight, brawl, or something like that, not protesting, which again seems to me different than what the initial intent of the statute as a whole was. So thank you.
Thank you for your argument.
So I guess I would begin just by taking issue with opposing counsel's summary of the criminal complaints in this matter is not alleging any likely to produce great bodily harm or death. I think the reason that the criminal complaint goes through kind of a summary of the context of how frequent these takeovers have been and what has occurred in other instances is all getting at the likelihood, as well as, you know, going into great detail. These both are lengthy complaints going into great detail. All of the conduct as well as the social media promotion and organization of the events. So I think in some ways, these complaints and these cases are extraordinary for how detailed and how factually developed they are even before bringing the charge. So at this probable cause stage, I think the criminal complaints And then when you also get to view the actual videos of the surveillance videos from the helicopters, as well as the two social media videos that were entered into evidence, I think there's robust evidence in the record to support at least a probable cause determination that there are sufficient facts, that it was reasonably probable that these vehicles constituted dangerous weapons, and that it presents a fact question to bring to the juries.
You agree that at trial, the state, if we were to reverse, the state would have the burden at trial to establish, to present some evidence to show that these vehicles used in this manner are likely to produce great bodily harm or death, however we define likely. And it seems like we've got a few different options presented to us. Do you
yes.
agree with that?
Yes. And
Just to clarify, by some evidence, are you suggesting expert testimony or just the videos?
And I can't speak to that at this time because of the posture that we're in of this case. And, you know, I'm the appellate attorney. It would go back to the trial attorney to create the trial strategy and trial preparation. But I think it could certainly be more than what is presented here at the charging stage. It would definitely, you know, there would be time and opportunity to consider expert testimony, to gather more evidence regarding, you know, what conduct occurred in these incidents, you know, leading up to them afterwards, as well as what's occurred in other takeovers that have also, you know, been associated with the respondent or other actors and participants. Since I didn't touch on the statutory interpretation of armed with in my principal argument, you know, I would just, as I stated in my reply brief, the state's position is that respondents' interpretation is unreasonable. And so under the plain meaning, there is only one reasonable interpretation of armed with, and that cannot be limited to something that can be, that is handheld. You know, I think because it, you can't, when looking at plain meaning, you can't just think of any possible interpretation. It needs to be reasonable. And so we submit that it is unreasonable, and therefore you don't have to get into the ambiguity because it is unambiguous. And there's only one interpretation that is not limited to something that is handheld. So I guess unless the court has any additional questions for me, I would just conclude by saying that we ask this court to reverse the district court's dismissal for lack of probable cause. We believe that there is a fact question on each and every element of these offenses, and these cases should be remanded to proceed to trial. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you both very much for your arguments this morning. The case was well briefed and well argued. It is now submitted to us. We will be issuing our decision within the statutory time frame. And that ends our very short oral calendar this morning as well. The court will